opportunity to give a seminar here. I will talk about a project that I finished with my Cologne supervisor, Simon Trebs, in this summer, and with Jean-Marie Stéphane. It is about, this project occurred from a discussion that we had with Roger Malcolm when he was visiting us in Cologne a few years ago, about putting the phenomena of topological entropy or topological order in a classical context. So let me first, as an outline, let me first point out what we mean when we use this classical context with things like topological order or entanglement entropy or the toric code, which are actually all quantum topics. And then briefly sketch the numerical machinery that we apply. And then we're driving out this toric code, but in two different ways out of its topological topologically ordered phase. Once by a perturbation, by a local perturbation, which then induces a phase transition, and then in another way by thermal fluctuation, so by introducing a finite temperature. And then at the end, I'd like to provide an outlook on work in progress and doing this on a three-dimensional toric code. So you're probably familiar with entanglement entropy in a condensed matter context. So we can use this this approach, this quantity, to learn about entanglement or correlations in the ground state of a many-body quantum system. And what we do is we have to bipartite our system into two different parts, A and B, and then compute the subsystem entropy of this part A. And we do it by first calculating the reduced density matrix of this subsystem and then plugging it into this entanglement formula, which is an analogon of the classical Shannon or Shannon entropy from thermodynamics or information theory. And this we call a von Neumann entropy. And to get this reduced density matrix, we first have to trace out all the degrees of freedom in part A. So this corresponds somehow to measuring all or performing all possible measurements in this part B to get this reduced density matrix of part A only. And there is a generalization of this von Neumann entropy, which are called Rényi entropies, which have an additional index here, an index n, and it's the trace of this density matrix to some power n. And the advantage of this one is that we can access it by Monte Carlo methods if n is an integer. And also, in the limit where n goes to 1, we reobtain the von Neumann entropy. And one of the interesting things about entanglement entropy is that in quantum system, it scales with the boundary that separates part A from part B. So the leading order in this entanglement entropy is with the boundary. And even more interesting are subleading corrections to this so-called boundary or area law, which can be, for example, a logarithmic correction that can come up in due to corners in the bipartition or Goldstone modes, and which have a universal character. So they can be used to characterize phase transitions independent of the details of the lattice. And the topic of this talk is another subleading contribution, which is a constant contribution, usually denoted with a negative sign, which indicates topological order. Okay, so this is quantum. So how can we do this, apply this in a classical context? So in a classical system, there is no entanglement. But what we can do is, instead of the reduced density matrix and instead of the trace, we can perform the sum over probabilities of a statistical mechanics ensemble. So the definition of the Rényi entropy looks very similar to the quantum one. And we have these probabilities over some ensemble. And the counterpart to tracing out, or the equivalent to tracing out the part B, then looks like this. So we have to, in order to get this probability, which is only related to subsystem A, we have to sum over all possible configurations in part B. And then once we have this quantity, since there's no entanglement, we now don't expect an area law, but a volume law. So to scale it with the volume of the subsystem A. But then we also expect that there is some subleading constant contribution which detects topological order in this classical system. And one common sense, now we have a volume law, unlike in the quantum case, this quantity is not symmetric under exchange of part A and B. Okay, so this is about the quantity that we want to compute. What about the...
Sure. Does it depend on the basis you do the sampling in? I'm not sure if it does or not.
I think it shouldn't. No. Maybe I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure about the leading term here, but not the interesting part. Okay, so what about the model then? I believe most of you have heard of this famous toric code in the original quantum version. It's defined on a square lattice, where the degrees of freedom are located on the bonds here, and it has two four-body interactions. One is acting on the vertices, like these here, and multiplies the spins here at every vertex. And the other one is on the plaquettes and multiplies their x spin component here. So since we're interested in the ground state, what this part does is it forces the spin configuration, say in the z basis here, into closed loops. So we have periodic boundary condition here. That's why it's called toric. So at every vertex, we must have an even number of spins pointing up and down. So either 2, like here, or 0, like here, or 4, like here. So this is what this part here does. So we must only have closed loops in our configuration. And this part then, so sigma x, is a spin flip in the sigma z basis. So this part is then you can see as flipping plaquettes. So if we have the plaquette operator of this plaquette, it would flip all these spins here. And since we can do it on every plaquette, we need a superposition of all accessible plaquette flipped states from this one with the same weight. So this curly L here, it's now a sum over all loop configurations that satisfy this constraint. And this is then the ground state wave function here. But this ground state is only a quarter of the truth, because this is not the only possibility, because there are some loops which are special. Loops can wind around the lattice like this. And a loop like this is called non-contractible. It's not accessible from this particular configuration by consecutively flipping plaquettes. So it is valid, it's a valid configuration, but does not belong to this, to the ground state superposition that comes out of this one. So you can have a winding loop, a single winding loop around this direction or around this direction, or both of them or none of them. So you get four different so-called topological sectors. So the ground state is fourfold degenerate. We have four of these superpositions here. Okay, so what's now the classical counterpart? What we do is we keep this constraint, but now having Ising spins, simple Ising spins. So we keep the constraints of only closed loops, but instead of a quantum mechanical superposition, we put this in a statistical mechanics ensemble where every configuration has the same weight. Just like here, so that the partition function looks like this. this is then our classical toric code. And what we want to do now is, since there is this every loop configuration goes into this ensemble, we call this a loop gas, same here. And we now want to apply an external field, so we call it loop tension, but it's just the magnetic field, to eventually force all spins to point in the same direction and thereby destroying this topological order, this fourfold degeneracy of the ground state. This also has this fourfold, you wouldn't call it maybe not degeneracy, but there are four sets in this ensemble, in the statistical mechanical ensemble. Okay, applying this field, so by adding it to the Hamiltonian, we get this as our classical Hamiltonian, and we expect there to be a phase transition, which is actually very simple. But what we want to see is if this phase transition is expressed in the gamma, in the constant correction to the volume law. It's expected to be some non-zero value in the still topologically ordered phase below the critical loop tension, and then vanish. And this phase transition is very, very easy because it can be understood from mapping the two-dimensional classical toric code to a two-dimensional Ising model by simply putting Ising spins in the middle of plaquettes and identifying the presence of a loop with a domain wall in the Ising model. So what costs energy here? A spin pointing up costs energy here. Costs energy here by opposite sign of the Ising spins. So the phase transition of this Ising model without a field. So it's an Ising model just in temperature. So the temperature phase transition of this Ising model is the Onsager solution is exactly the same as the phase transition here. So that's where we expect this gamma. Okay, so yeah.
I just want to make sure I understand the mapping. So here this mapping only works when you actually take J and D to infinity.
Yes, that's true. The constraint that we have only closed loop is then implicitly fulfilled by this.
So
I think.
Exactly what simulation is it going to be considered for?
Yes. In the first part, yes. So but we don't simulate the Ising model, we simulate this one.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. The numerical approach that we apply, so if we have a finite loop tension, then we have no longer the weights of one for the loop configurations, but this Boltzmann factors here with the loop tension and the magnetization of a special closed loop configuration. So this is all over closed loops here. And we don't have any temperature in here. We just consider it to be so low that we have only to consider this kind of excitation or this kind of weights here. And then and the Rényi entropies can be computed by applying this replica trick, which looks in the classical variant like this. We have two copies of our system, and the region of interest A, there we identify the degrees of freedom with each other, and in the two parts B, they can fluctuate independently from each other. And then we compute the partition function of this modified system and have to find the ratio between this one and the usual, so the one without this identification here to the square, and this gives us the second, we will focus only on the second Rényi entropy here. And what we are doing, since we're identifying the degrees of freedom here, if we want to flip a spin here or perform a modification here, we also have to do it here, which costs us twice as much in energy than doing it here. So we can see it as effectively this part of the model is at 2H and this part is at H. So this will become important in a few slides. And then one comment on the Monte Carlo update that we wanted to do it non-locally. So instead of doing plaquette flips to generate new generations, we performed like a directed walk here where we flip all spins along the walk. But this makes it a little bit complicated if we enter part A, because then we also have to flip these ones and we have to walk so long until we rejoin the first spin here, because we must have closed loops. And this one, this setting here gives us an additional task to also walk along here until we meet this spin here again. But then we get a non-local update. Okay, so this is now about calculating the entropy, but we only want the constant contribution out of it. So what we apply is It's a famous trick, which is much more efficient than performing a finite size scaling. This Levin-Wen trick, where we have four different bipartitions here and compute the entanglement entropy of every of these bipartitions, and summing or counting these two positively and these two negatively, which results in deleting all bulk contributions, which is important since we have a volume law, all boundary contributions, and all corners. So everything is canceled in this scheme, except the constant part if it's different, and it is different. In the quantum case, it is 2 log 2 for these two bipartitions and log 2 in these two. So if we do this summing here, we end up having 2 log 2 as our gamma. And in the classical Tory code, the story is a bit different. There we need a disconnected region B, which is only the case in this bipartition here, to get a contribution at all. But the same scheme gives us then a log 2 as our contribution here. And this scheme was published in 2006 back-to-back to an alternative scheme by Kitaev and Preskill. And it can be used in the quantum case as well, but not here, because because this scheme has only connected regions, but we need a disconnected part B. So we cannot use this one for this setting here. Okay, let's now check if we've done everything right by computing the mutual information as a check. So mutual information means that we compute, so between part A and B, we compute both entanglement entropies and subtract the entanglement entropy of the total system. And we see that for different system sizes, near our Onsager phase transition here, there's somehow a crossing point showing up between different system sizes. And since mutual information has these two parts of the mutual information have a boundary, but this one has not, the total mutual information scales with the boundary. That's why I divide by the length of the boundary minus one. And this minus one is quite interesting because it emphasizes why we call this an information theory perspective. If we have only closed loops and we have a bipartition, then this bipartition, the cut of the bipartition, is crossed by an even number of loops. So we must have the same number of loops going in the subsystem and going out. So if we were to count the spins along the boundary, along the bipartition, we know already what the last spin of this counting must be. Because we know if we have counted all the spins except the last one, we know what the last one must be because we need an even number. And this is precisely the subtraction that we are doing here to account for this bit of information. Let's zoom into this crossing point here to see if it really gradually approaches the critical loop tension. And it does. If we perform a 1 over L scaling of the location of the crossing point, we quite nicely end up at the critical loop tension in the thermodynamic limit. Okay, now we come to the most important plot, central result of this study, the topological entropy itself, the constant contribution of this transition. And we expected it to be log 2 at zero, at no perturbation here. And also we expected it to be 0 once all this, the system is trivial. So at high loop tensions, all spins are aligned and it's completely trivial. But here in the middle happens something that we didn't expect at first. We see that upon increasing system size, this is nice in classical systems, you can go to high system sizes, there happens this overshooting. And it's not some singularity because this peak broadens the larger you get in the system size. And so it looks like if it goes up to 2 log 2 before finally going down to 0. So the question is, what happens between this critical loop tension and this half of the critical loop tension? It's related to the second Rainier entropy, actually. It's related to the definition of the Rainier entropy. So we've already seen that below half of the critical value, everything is topologically ordered. A is topologically ordered and B is topologically ordered, so we should get these constant contributions. But if we go to value of H between HC over 2 and HC, I told you that in the replica trick in this classical setting, part A effectively is at 2H, at twice the magnetization, the loop tension as part B. So part A becomes already trivial at HC over 2. So above this HC over 2, this part A is trivial, and only part B is topologically ordered. And therefore, this what we count here is just the number of boundaries that we have. So here are two boundaries, which give us 2 log 2, one boundary, and two boundaries again, which count us in this log 2 per boundary. And since this is not related to topology, we dubbed it connectivity contribution. And since we claim it's nothing topological, we should see this in a system which has nothing to do with topology. So we checked it on the simplest model we could think of, the two-dimensional Ising model. It has nothing to do with the mapping, so that we took this. But we applied the Levin-Wendt scheme to the two-dimensional Ising model, and indeed we see that between the Onsager critical point and half of this value, we get a log 2 contribution. And this is even much simpler to understand if you remember the Levin-Wendt scheme. Once subsystem A of Ising spins is ordered, all spins have the same direction here. So either they are all pointing up or down, which gives you a log 2 of information, a log 2. Here the same and here the same. But here, part A is ordered, but all spins can point up here and up here, or up, down, down, up, down, down. So here there's 2 log 2, there's 2 bits of information in this. And this is precisely the reason why we get this log 2 contribution in the Ising model. And that's why we call it connectivity contribution.
So I think I missed a bit. Why are we putting on this disconnected boundary for the Rubaga slide?
Yeah.
Why do you need this disconnected region B to get log 2 in the first case?
Here?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the way Maria has put it is she says that you count the number of boundaries, which is 2, but then you get an opposed contribution by every bulk. So here you have 2 boundaries and 2 bulks, which gives 0. And here you have 2 boundaries, 1 boundary, 1 bulk, 1 boundary, 1 bulk. But here 2 boundaries, 1 bulk, which leaves you log 2 contribution here. So yeah, it's to do with counting bits in the inside. So plaquette terms on the inside and on the boundaries somehow. Okay, so this was the phase transition one more comment on the mutual information. This is the same plot of the mutual information, but the nice thing is that with this connectivity contribution in background, we can understand what happens here, because SA and SB both have a connectivity contribution here, which lowers the mutual information, but this lowering constant gets suppressed as we divide by larger numbers. So if we perform a linear fit to this mutual information like this and look at the constant contribution A, we see that we see this connectivity contribution between the critical point and its artifact here. Okay, this was now about the phase transition by a loop tension. Now let's turn on finite temperature. So there, now we can break this loop gas constraint. We can have open loops, which cost an energy. So the number, this d here, is the number of defects in the configuration, and we get a different weight for a configuration, for in principle an arbitrary spin configuration with this number of defects here. And it's been analytically shown for the quantum case by Castelnuovo and Charmant that we expect the breakdown of topological order by applying finite temperature to decrease. So this point decreases logarithmically in system size. So this second plateau we don't have. We don't have the second plateau in the classical case. We only have this one. But we expect it to decrease here in this logarithmically in the system size. And we checked that. And indeed, we see that it decreases here. And as the point where we decided where is the breakdown, we took the derivative of these plots, and then their maximum value. So here's the maximum value of the derivative, and performed a log a scaling over 1 over the log of this the linear system size, and we see they lie on the line and meet quite nicely zero temperature in the thermodynamic limit as the point of the breakdown of topological order. Okay, so the conclusion thus up to here is that we can apply the classical quantities or classical context to the phenomenon of topological order. And the nice thing in classical system is that we can access large systems, and we have detected this this connectivity contribution, which is not killed by the Lewin-Wendt scheme. And also we believe that it could be relevant for quantum systems if we have a look at quantum systems at finite temperatures, because then we also have in the replica trick, we have one part of the system at 2 beta and the other part, the part B, at beta. Okay, let me put an outlook on the three-dimensional case. So the first thing we were interested in was the connectivity contribution of the three-dimensional Ising model, and we like designed another Lewin-Wendt scheme, which these four columns here, and then subtracting or adding these parts, subtracting this one, and we would expect that these four give a log two each, so 4 log two here, minus 1 log two here, minus 1 log two here, plus 1 log two here, which would give, we would expect 3 log two as our connectivity contribution, and that's precisely what we get. There's this plateau here at 3 log 2. What is interesting is that somehow a second peak shows up here, which is, yeah, we don't know what it exactly means here. We were thinking of that if we have a three-dimensional object or three-dimensional bipartition, then the boundary between the two parts of the system is a two-dimensional object which could have its own criticality, more or less. So we plotted this dashed line here, which is the solid line is the critical point of the three-dimensional Ising model, and this is half of it. And the dashed line is half the critical value of the two-dimensional Ising model, so half of the Onsaga solution. So because we were thinking maybe this thing has to do with some criticality of the boundary between part A and B. But we're not totally convinced of this here. Okay, this was the three-dimensional Ising model. Let's then look at the three-dimensional toric code in this particular definition here that you could have other definitions as well. But this is a definition by Castelnuovo and Charmant, where they have the vertices in the three-dimensional setting here are now six-body operators, because multiplying all adjacent spins to the vertex, But the plaquettes stay plaquettes, and we have three orientations of the plaquettes in this here. And since these two contributions here are not dual to each other, like in the 2D case, we have two different classical versions of this. Either we take this in Ising spins or this in Ising spins. And one of them, so now we are only looking at finite temperature, one of them gives us the same scaling, the same breakdown as in a two-dimensional model when we take when we excite the vertices here, this one. But the other one indeed gives us a finite temperature phase transition, which is known. And this, and Castelnuovo and Chamon have provided a nice view, a nice explanation of why there is a finite temperature phase transition. What we have to understand is how the topological sector in the three-dimensional model is detected, can be detected. So for the vertices, so fulfilling the constraint imposed on all the vertices leaves degeneracy in the model, and we can detect in which sector we are by these membranes, so these planes here in the model. We have to multiply all the spins on this membrane, and depending if it's plus or minus one, it gives us the sector. And there are three different ways to position a plane here in this cube. So the degeneracy is 8. For plaquettes, it's different. So plaquettes are identified by loops again. But here as well, we can have three different loops in the model. And so what happens if we have now excitations of plaquettes or vertices is in the 2D case, if we have two defects here, so defects must come in pairs, and the defects are on different sides of these identifying loops, so these loops which should identify the topological sector, they would read off a different topological sector. So the information about the topological sector is lost due to these defects here. And the same is true for the three-dimensional case where these are the membranes. So imagine pulling this here out of the plane. So then we have a membrane here and a membrane here and defects here, and the membranes would read off different signs. So this is the reason why the topological order does not survive finite temperature in the thermodynamic limit. But the situation is different if we have loops in a three-dimensional system, because, and in addition, have defects which are confined, because the defects induced by plaquettes are confined, at least below the critical temperature. And so we can deform this loop into this one by local transformations, and they do read off the same topological sector. So topological information is not lost in this case here. The situation changes once the defects deconfine, and it happens at this critical temperature 1.3, which is known, and we can find this transition then by the simple investigation of the specific heat. So no entropy at all. The specific heat of the three-dimensional toric code gives us precisely the critical temperature here as where it's divergent. And we also had a look at the mutual information here of the toric code now again by computing the entanglement entropy. And again, we see that here at the critical temperature, so it's one over 1.31. So we get the crossing or splitting point as an indicator of the phase transition. Okay, so that's work in progress. So what we can see already that in general, the approach is applicable in the 3D case as well. We are not sure of if 2D boundaries can have an additional criticality in this 3D setting, and we are also not 100% sure how we would do the Levin-Wen extraction scheme in 3D case. So one proposal would be this one. And what's known before, but it becomes clear now that even in 3D, one of the excitations is not stable. So we would have to go to 4D to have a stable error correcting code. Thanks. Yes.
The question is, suppose you can sample the von Neumann entropy, which is then the limit of n index goes to 1. Do you think that this artifact is going to go away, or
yes,
going to persist?
No. It's really, so this artifact is really comes from the definition of the Rainier entropy.
Right.
And the replica trick is a nice picture, but it's exact. So it's really, so you can see in the replica picture that since you have two critical points, yes, you have different critical points for part A and B, that which you wouldn't have for Neumann entropy.
I see. So like numerically, is it possible to have a direct
entropy for a classical system? And not for a classical system.
But because you're busy focusing on the classical model, so I'm curious whether it's somehow easier.
Yeah, I guess so, because it's not so hard to just sum over all possible states than in a quantum system.
Right. So the second question is, do you know how does the mutual information scale at right at the critical point as a system size, as a function system size, subsystem size?
Yeah, I think, so you want to know, so what's the scaling of this point here.
Right. So I suppose imagine we have a classical system at zero temperature. Let's take anti-ferromagnetic icing model on triangular lattice. At a zero temperature, it's known that it's actually a critical phase. While it's not stable once you introduce finite temperature fluctuations, but right at zero temperature is a critical system. I suppose I put this thing in the computer and compute the mutual information between two regions.
Yes.
Yeah, so. Right, so I wonder how does this thing would scale as a system volume or area, or there's no rhythmic correction.
So I'm not sure about the scaling, but Jean-Marie has worked out something that he would expect that the asymptotic value of this, like of the mutual information at the critical point, is not zero. It's some finite value here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's but. I would have to check in which is the law that it would take, and also in finite system size, it's dangerous to make strong conclusions of it.
I see.
So this 3 Levin-Wen scheme you're saying that you use for the Ising model doesn't work for the
yeah. So actually, I didn't comment on it, but we had this story code drawn in this rotation by 45 degrees, because here, when we do the bipartition, we do it like this here. So we do the bipartition like from direction, so 45 degree rotated to in relation to the story code, because we believe that we have less finite size effects, because then lines of bipartitions cut plaquettes and vertices exactly into 2-2 pairs. And only corners are then 1-3 cuts here. And we tried to do this for the 3D case as well. But then, you get this octagon in a cube, which then at least at the surfaces cuts the stars, the vertices, and the plaquettes exactly into two equal size parts. But we'd like to understand if it really matters if we're doing it.
So can I see the mutual information at the 3D case?
Yeah.
what we got here. So there's no logarithmic crossover here because it's a actual. So that critical point's actually 3D Ising universality class. If you collapse the specific heat, you get the exponents for 3D Ising.
Yeah.
So is there any collapse you can do on the mutual information to see the universality class in this case?
You mean like scaling of
some scaling?
Scaling of the critical of the crossing point or so? I don't. So the problem is that it's more splitting than crossing. So we didn't try it because here the data is not yet precise enough. But what confuses me is that you also that you don't really see if you don't see this like gradually approaching the like the final thermodynamic curve here, but it's they're close to they're already very close because the constant contribution is that we would expect here is divided by the area, so it's by 20 by 20 say, and then it decreases it kills it off immediately. But maybe one could still perform some crossover, maybe rather on this side, but I'm not sure. Here it seems very identical as well.
So I just comment on Yuan's point. So I think if you're at the critical points, so what Jean-Marie showed in, say you're just in a two-dimensional Ising model, so the 1+1, so basically you have a shape dependence that's left because it's gapless.
Right.
So if you vary the shape of your region A, you get some complicated functional form. So what Jean-Marie showed is if you know how to control that shape, say you take a torus and cut it into two cylinders, and you vary that the cylinder length, you get a function out of that, and you can relate that function to the 1+1 CFD. So the classical entropy can extract the central charge of the 1+1 CFD. So presumably there's a relationship in 3D also, but I guess it's not known what that is. It's not known what that shape-dependent function is.
Yeah, but one thing about this 3D classical toric code is not like it's not in a 2+1 sense the quantum toric code. It's just a mapping.
It's dual to the 3D Ising model. So
yeah.
It's just a three-dimensional Ising.
It's true.
Okay, no more questions. Then let's thank Hannes again.